slow on the uptake there. Y'all really know how to throw a party. I'm telling you, you've got everything you need for a fiesta. You have got this beautiful surroundings. You've got bright, fantastic colors, and you got a lot of wild and crazy people. And I thought, this is it. All you need is the pinata. And I'm from Texas, and I can get that for you. So I am really, really grateful to be here this afternoon. My name is Stephanie Butler, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. Hi, everybody. This is a very humbling and joyful way for me to spend a couple of days. When I see, I've never been here before, and when I see what you get to see pretty much on a regular basis, it takes my breath away. I live in central Texas in what we call the Hill Country, and we've called it God's Country forever. And I lived there forever. And then I had an opportunity to go to a couple of places around the United States, and I think, you know, God's got more than one place. And I think he double-dipped y'all. You know, I think he just gave you. And we drove through the rain yesterday, and I had my first resentment in New Mexico. First time I've ever been here. How dare you let it rain? You know, felt extremely victimized for a couple of minutes. And then the sun came out, and then we got to the top of the little thing, and then we could see Taos down here, and it was just beautiful. I would like to thank Sue and Diana. Diana's emailed me, and the committee, thank you for the invitation and the warm welcome that you have given me. And we had a lovely dinner last night with some great Al-Anon gals, and I got a gift bag in my room, and then my friend Meg came down from Salt Lake City, Utah, and we've gotten to spend some quality time together. And then I went to a fantastic Al-Anon meeting this morning. I'm telling you, I get a little bit spooked when I go, and there's like, oh, I never heard that before. Well, I didn't know I had to work on that. You know, oh my gosh, you mean I have to pray more? You know, my knees are tired. What a great, wonderful experience. And then to hear Larry and Ray, and I didn't get to hear the young people speaker, and he's from Austin, which is just down the road from where I live. And so I'm going to have to get his CD and listen to him, and I know the rest of the weekend will just be wonderful for us. So anyway, thank you. I am the one that receives here. I always am the one that receives, and I am humbled to be asked to share with you. The Al-Anon program suggests, or the Al-Anon literature suggests, that we share with you in a general way how sick I was, how well I am, and, oh, don't laugh. That was not funny. And then what helped me to get well, with the emphasis being on what helped me to get well. And that's what I'm going to try to do this afternoon. I was born the oldest of three into a Catholic Italian family. Got it. I'm a Capricorn. Oh, yeah, and it's very sad, Catholic, Italian, all that stuff. But wait, the zipper. I was born on Christmas Eve. Me and Jesus. I came first. I always thought the celebrations were always about me. You know, once I got older, and I would have told you that any alcoholic I met was the most egotistical person out there. And then I started listening to myself, me and Jesus, you know. And this Christmas Eve, I will be 65, and I am so grateful to be sucking air still. So to tell you a little bit about my family, you know, when I got into the program and we were asked to do a four-step, and my sponsor in Al-Anon asked me to write a life story. So I went back to see where the dysfunction came from. How did I get to be hooked up with this guy that I was sure had just messed up my life when I was doing so well? And then in my life story, I discovered that I was raised in a dysfunctional home. I don't like that word, but my daddy was a workaholic. He worked three jobs to try to support my family. My mother was raised as one of eight children on a dirt farm outside of Fort Worth, Texas, and her daddy was a bootlegger. And a lot of my mother's brothers had what they called drinking problems. And so my mother was raised in an, I believe, in an alcoholic home by an untreated Al-Anon. Now, I need to tell you that lots of times you hear people refer to somebody that's doing some really sick behavior. She must be an Al-Anon. No, you are an Al-Anon. If you go to meetings, work the steps, get a sponsor, read the literature. You are an untreated Al-Anon if you hang out with the people that love to drink and you don't do anything about it. So my mother was raised by an untreated Al-Anon. Therefore, I believe that I was raised by an untreated Al-Anon. My mother was and is today an untreated Al-Anon. So in this home world, and my parents were social drinkers. They never, I mean, they would have a party once every 6 months and people would come over and, you know, but I am Italian. And so we did have some wine on occasion, but nobody ever. We just, alcohol was not visible in my home of my family of origin. So I know that there's other things going on. So I went to look at some of my old beliefs. One of my old beliefs was, if you did good, you got good. Well, I thought that if I didn't do good, I was going to go to hell in a hurry. And so I always did the right thing. I tried so hard to not break any rules, not to color outside the lines. I was scared to death of what would happen if I messed up. And so I tried to be just as good as I could be. And another belief I had was that you looked great and I felt very less than. So I compared my insides with your outsides. So you're always doing a whole lot better than I am because I don't feel very secure inside of myself. Another thing was, in my family of origin, is that we are always fine. Everybody is fine. There is never any emotion expressed other than you are fine. We are, you don't get, you know, you're not sad, you're not lonely, you're not frustrated, you're not, you're just fine. So my mama had a sign in our front yard that said, "We are fine, thank you very much." And to reinforce that, I saw my mama get mad at my daddy one time in the 18 years that I lived at home. She started crying, she walked out, slammed the door, got in the car and drove off. So what I learned from that one little moment was when people get angry, they leave. So I will do anything I can to keep you from getting angry. My people pleasing was put in place on that day because I don't want you to leave. And of course, my mom came back. I don't remember how that happened. And I have sat in an awful lot of meetings where people talk about being raised in a rageful home. And I know that that is damaging. I also believe that it's very damaging to be raised in a home where no feelings are validated. It's not okay to be who you are and feel the way you feel. It's just not. You're going to be fine and you're going to make us look good and that's just the end of it. So that's how I was raised. So no wonder I was a little bit sick. Okay. And then when I was a senior in high school, I met the man that I fell in love with. His name is Bill. And we dated for 4.5 years, and after we graduated from college, we got married. And we moved from San Antonio, Texas, to Austin, Texas. And that's where I spent most of my adult life. So, Bill, I get to be a school teacher. That's all I ever wanted to do was be a school teacher. So I'm teaching school, and Bill's got a job, and we're just as happy as we can be. Everything seems to be going along really well. Now, for his job, he does travel periodically, and he would call me and say, "You know what? They serve free drinks on the plane." And I said, "They do? Yeah." And then he'd call, and he'd say, "You know, we all went and had our meeting for happy hour. You know, that's a great way to have a meeting, have a happy hour." And, you know, and then some beer started showing up in the refrigerator. And since I'd never heard any of this or seen any of it, I started paying really close attention. And so, we're doing everything, but I'm teaching school and he's got a job and I love him and he loves me and everything's really good. And in 1969, I found out I was pregnant. And the only thing I'd ever wanted to do besides teach school was to be a mommy. And so I am thrilled to death to be pregnant. So I need to just tell you this one little story. My Catholic Italian cousin was getting married in San Antonio one Saturday morning. So I am 8 months pregnant, and Bill and I are going to go to San Antonio from Austin for the wedding. And I'm telling you, it is a beautiful day. The sun is shining and there's a breeze and the wedding is just magnificent. And the reception, there's champagne flowing and everybody's having a good time. And they are very happy to see Bill and I because I am pregnant. And you are supposed to have babies when you are Catholic and Italian, and I was doing it right. And so they were really glad to see me. So after the reception, we all went out to the airport because my cousin and his bride were going to fly to Hawaii for their honeymoon. So we are standing out at the airport, and different relatives come up to me and say, "Stephanie, your husband is so delightful." Oh, good. Somebody else came up and said, "You know, Bill has really kept us in stitches." I said, "Okay." Now, the reason that I was a little hesitant was because Bill was raised as an only child by a single mom. And when you put him in these Catholic Italian gatherings, he was not a happy camper. So with everybody telling me how funny he was and how much they enjoyed him, I thought, well, maybe he's gotten with the program. You know, this is good, this is good. And then a few minutes later, Bill came up and said, "I'll be back in just a minute." So the honeymoon couple get in the plane and they're flying off and we're waving and we get ready to leave the airport and we can't find Bill. So we have him paged and we go up and down the aisles and we go out to the car and there is no Bill. Finally, my brother-in-law finds him and he comes out and he said, "Steph, I found Bill." And I said, "You did? Where is he?" And he said, "He's passed out in the men's room." I said, "Oh my gosh." Well, we had to get an airport attendant to take the door off the hinges. And we needed to get a wheelchair. And they held him up while I buckled his britches. And then we put him in the wheelchair. And then we start to wheel him out of the bathroom. And he's sliding out and I'm shoving him back up again. And I am 8 months pregnant, and my brother-in-law says, "Would you like for me to push the wheelchair?" And I said, "Oh, no, 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 he's my husband. I will push this wheelchair." So I'm pushing the wheelchair out of the airport. Butler slides out. We slide him back in again. My mother's walking along beside me, and she is saying, "I cannot believe that my son-in-law is drunk." I said, "Mama, he's not drunk. Bless his little heart." If you ever hear me say, "Bless his little heart," I am having an Al-Anon slip. I said, "Mama, he is not drunk. He is sick. Bless his little heart." You know, so we're walking down the airport and she keeps saying in a loud voice, "Oh, I can't believe my son-in-law got so drank so much he's drunk." I go, "Mama, stop, stop." Now, the reason I'm telling you that story is because 19 years later, I was in a psychiatrist's office saying, "Do you think he could have a brain tumor? I'm pretty sure it's a brain tumor. Operate on this sucker, pull it out, and let us get on with the rest of our lives." That was the day that my denial got put in place. He is not drunk, he is just sick. You know, he's not bouncing into walls. He's got a brain tumor. You know, I mean, I didn't know anything about the disease of alcoholism. Well, in August of 69, a beautiful little baby girl was born. Her name is Laura Janice. And then 21 months later, our son Wes is born. So I'm just about as happy as I can be. I've taught school. That was my profession. I'm with the man I love. We have two healthy children. Thank you, God. And I get to be a stay-at-home mom. What more could anybody want? There was just this little problem. I have this little hole inside of me that needs to get filled up by the outside. And so I am doing everything I can to get this inside filled up. So what I did was I decided if you love somebody, you spent time with them. So every time Bill Butler went fishing, we all went fishing. Every time Bill Butler went hunting, we all went hunting. Every time Bill Butler went bowling, we all went bowling. Now, good news is my daughter can skin a deer faster than anybody you ever saw. Bad news is I nearly loved three people dead. My idea of love was enmeshment. It was spending time together. And I was trying so hard to make our picture look good because I had brought the sign from my mother's yard. We are fine, thank you very much. And so, you know, and I'm trying to do everything. And the kids are growing up and Bill's drinking, of course, is escalating. And I have to just tell you this one little sideline. My daughter's middle name is Anger. She will tell you that when she was born, she came out of the chute pissed off. I mean, that's what she will say to you. I was born angry. So here comes this kid, and she's angry, and, you know, but I'm trying to make everybody look good. So I'm just doing everything I can. And so I was a Brownie Scout leader. I was PTA president. I built a playscape. I mean, I was in a service organization. I did everything I could so people would say, God, Stephanie, great, great job, Stephanie. You're doing so good. Because the kids were growing up, and, you know, Wes was following along like his mother wanted him to, but Laura was, you know, coloring outside the lines, and Bill's drinking was escalating, and so I was feeling all of this, got to keep it going, got to get it right, got to get it right. Well, I have to tell you this little story. We have a border collie, and her name is Flopsy. Prettiest border collie you ever saw in your life. Flopsy's about to have puppies, and we've never had that experience before, so I decided that I wanted her to look nice for delivery day. So I shampooed Flopsy. And then I remembered, sometimes when you shampoo a dog, they're supposed to run free and dry, and sometimes you're supposed to towel dry them. And I wanted to do it right. So I looked at the bottle, and it said, do not use on pregnant dogs. And I went, oh, my gosh, I have killed these puppies. So I called Dr. Pigott, who was our vet, and I said, Dr. Pigott, you won't believe what I just did. And he said, well, it's about 2 weeks till those puppies are due. Let's wait and see what happens. Sure enough, 2 weeks later, the first puppy was born, and it was born dead. And I called Dr. Pigott, and I said, Dr. Pigott, I have killed these puppies. And he said, Stephanie, there's a lot of puppies in there. Let's just wait and see. So about an hour later, another puppy was born, and it was born alive. So I called Dr. Pigott, and I said, I did not kill all of these puppies. We have a live one. And he said, that's really good. And then about a half an hour later, another puppy was born, and it was okay. So I called Dr. Pigott, and I said, Dr. Pigott, I really didn't kill all these puppies. I've got two now. And he said, that's good, Stephanie. Over the course of this day, Flopsy had seven puppies. I called Dr. Pigott after every puppy. The last puppy was born and had trouble breathing. And so I called Dr. Pigott, and I said, Dr. Pigott, I think she's had all these puppies, but we've got this little tiny one here, and I don't know what's going to happen. And he said, do you have any whiskey in your house? And I said, yes. And he said, well, put some whiskey on the end of a teaspoon. Put the teaspoon and let it run down the puppy's throat. Massage it a little bit, and it's going to break up all that phlegm. And I think your puppy will be okay. I said, okay, I think I can do that. And he said, and then, Stephanie, I want you to sit down and drink the rest of that bottle. That's a true story. And I want you to know, if I could have, I would have. I was so tired. You know, I think before you ever get into Al-Anon, they better say to you, are you tired? Because if you're tired, you probably belong here. But if you're not tired, you better go try to make everything work one more time, you know. So I am still trying to keep all the plates in the air. And, you know, now we've got one of the puppies died. We had six little puppies, and I was just thrilled to death with the puppies. But now I've got to do double duty. You know, you got to feed them this special stuff, and you got to get the kids off to school. And it was very hard to be me. And I'm watching Bill's drinking, and I'm not really happy about that. So I'm reminding him all the time about how much he's drinking, and I think it might be too many. And did he know he's already had three beers today? And, you know, that kind of thing was my mantra. That's what I was doing. And so here we are with, you know, I'm trying to do all this, and I have to tell you a little story. Laura was going to have jaw surgery. She was a beautiful girl. She's in high school. She was beautiful. But she was in the choir. And sometimes when she sang, her mouth would lock open. She was beautiful if you looked at her from the front, but if you turned her to the side, she had a very protruding chin. So we were told she needed to have jaw surgery. And so they were going to go in and crack this jawbone and slide her jaw back and then wire her mouth shut. I love that part. So we are in the hospital. Laura and I are in the hospital. It is the day for the big surgery. I am standing there. I'm very nervous because this is major surgery for our daughter. And I look around and I have my first moment of clarity. There is no Bill. I am doing this marriage and this family all by myself. And it is the first time in all those years that I had realized that. I was showing up, and I was doing what I was supposed to be doing, and Bill was absent. He was at home, passed out. He was drunk. And so from that day, in spring of 85, I started paying a lot of attention to his drinking and to our family dynamics. And as the rest of that year progressed, I decided, you know what? I think this man is killing himself with booze. He was puffing up like a little Pillsbury doughboy. He was forgetting. He'd come in and say, "What's for dinner?" And 2 minutes later, "What's for dinner?" That's when I thought he had the brain tumor. But he was just, I believe that the vodka he was drinking had gotten absorbed into his pores. I didn't know any of that. What I knew was that I thought my husband was dying, and I thought he was killing himself, and I loved him too much to watch it happen. So in July of 1985, I said to him, "You either have to get sober or you have to get out. I can't watch it. I love you too much, and I'm not going to let these kids and myself go down watching you die. I just can't do it." Well, he was so angry, and he said, "I'm leaving, but you'd have to drink too if you lived with you," which is so true. But I was not about to admit it at the time, because it was not any of my responsibility, you understand. If we just sobered him up, we would be fine. And so before and as this is all going down, my daughter is acting out worse than anything you ever saw in your life. She's breaking every rule she can find. So we took her to a psychologist. This is the week before I asked Bill to leave. And I said, "Would you please fix her? She is really messed up. She is the kid standing on the roof going, 'We are not fine. These people are crazy. Somebody better come help us.'" And that made me look bad, and I didn't like it, and so we're going to go get her fixed. You know how you cannot acknowledge the fact that it could possibly be me, and we needed something else to blame besides Bill and his drinking, so we're going to fix this acting out daughter. Well, we go to see this psychologist, and he met with me, and then he met with Bill, and then he met with Laura. And then he brought all three of us back together, and he said, "I need to tell you that of the three of you, your daughter is the healthiest." Well, Laura goes, "Yes!" Bill didn't want to pay the doctor. But you know what he says? He looked at me, and he said, "It looks like you're crying all the time." And I was. That's all I did. I was crying from the time I got up in the morning till the time I went to bed. I didn't know what to do. I was scared. I don't know how to tell you I'm scared. I cannot express my feelings, but I know how to cry. And he looked at Bill and he said, "It sounds to me like you're just drinking a little too much." And he looked at Laura and he said, "Now, we all know how you feel. So you are expressing your feelings. You're doing it inappropriately, but you are expressing your feelings." So about a week later, I got the courage up to ask Bill to leave. And he left. And I was so grateful because I just knew there had to be a change. I didn't know what was going to happen, but I knew that I couldn't do that anymore. I remember being as thin as I had ever been. I remember crying all the time. I remember being so tired. And after Bill had been gone for a couple of days, one of his friends from work called, and he said, "Stephanie, I understand you kicked Bill out." And I said, "Well, you know," I said, "I think he's going to die, Jerry." And he said, "Well, I am a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd like to take you to a meeting. Would you like to go with me?" And I went, "Yes." And so on July the 24th of 1985, I began this beautiful journey. Oh. And I went to my first Al-Anon meeting that day. And I sat in there, and I did not know a thing you said, but they said, just give us your first name. That's all I did for a year. But y'all were so loving. You said, just keep coming back. After a while, I could hear you say things to me like, did you know that alcoholism is a family illness? I didn't know that. Did you know that if you have raised children in an alcoholic home, you have raised sick kids? I thought my heart would break. And then they said, you did the very best you could with the knowledge that you had at the time. And then they said, you better get a sponsor. You better go to as many meetings as you can. You better read the literature. And you better take the focus off of that alcoholic and put it on you. Because you can save you. And I was just about ready to do something about me, so I was kind of glad to hear that. 2 weeks later, Bill called, and he said, you know, Stephanie, I've been out at Willie's, and I've been trying to sober myself up, and I can't do it. He said, I need some help. So on August the 6th of 1985, Bill began his spiritual journey. And that's all I ever wanted was for Bill to get sober, and I thought we were all going to be fine. You know, little did I know. So, you know, y'all told me to get a sponsor. And so I sat in one of the meetings one time and I heard this lady speak and I thought, my gosh, I think I'm in love with that woman. And so I asked her to be my sponsor and her name was Blanche. Now, I didn't know at the time that Blanche had 24 years in the program. And I did not know that she was what they called a black belt Al-Anon. But I did know that I loved to listen to her. So Blanche and I started working together. It was her belief that we met every week for 1 hour until we were through with the ninth step. She believed that I had to sit there with her. One of the great things that Blanche, she did so much for me, but one of the great things was that she touched my face and she said, it's okay to be who you are and feel the way you feel. That unconditional love that we get in these rooms. And then she said, we're going to have to change your concept of a higher power. You have a God that you are afraid of. And I said, yes. I said, I did it right. I followed all the rules. I didn't mess up. I was a good mom and I was a good wife and my family fell apart. And she said, Stephanie, that's not God doing that to you. That's a disease called alcoholism. And she said, God cannot do bad. He can only do good. And there's nothing you can do to make him stop loving you. There's nothing. So Blanche and I start meeting together, and Bill's going to meetings, and he and I come home, and I said, what'd you talk about? And he'd say the 11th step. What'd you talk about? And I'd say detachment. And I mean, it was just wonderful. I was just so happy to have. I just thought we were just, you know, we're going to live happily ever after. Well, Laura, she's a senior in high school. She has 3 months to graduation. She had broken some rule. I don't know what it was. She was grounded. She had been grounded for about a week. And I have to tell you, she did not like living with a drunk daddy. But she really did not like living with a sober daddy. So she had been grounded for a week, and a week is up, and it's a Sunday afternoon, and she came into Bill and I, and she said, you know, the University of Texas is playing baseball this afternoon, and I really would love to go see that game. Can I go? And so Bill and I talked about it, and we said, you know, she's been doing okay. Yeah, you can go. And we said, but we want you home by 6 o'clock this evening. She said, I'll be there. So Laura went to the ball game. 6 o'clock came, and Laura did not come home. She didn't come home Monday. She didn't come home Tuesday. Now, I have been sitting in Al-Anon meetings for a year, and I have been crying, and Blanche told me that I was grieving the loss of a dream because our family had been held hostage, more or less, to the disease of alcoholism. And so I knew that my children had been affected, But now I didn't know what to do. Y'all had given me some tools, but I didn't know how to get Laura to behave. Why wasn't she doing what I wanted her to do? We were getting better. Well, she's out of the house. I'm going to Al-Anon meetings, crying, of course, and y'all are saying to me things like, what would you be doing if this weren't happening? And I am saying to you, it is happening. Bill's going to his sponsor saying, you need, and Lon was wonderful, and Lon was telling Bill, love and accept her exactly where she is today. And Bill said, that's the problem. We don't know where she is today. Now, I am a school teacher. I had gone back to teaching after the kids had gotten older, and I believe that it is God's will for everybody to graduate from high school. I'm almost certain of that. So I am going to do whatever it takes to get this to happen. So I am trying to figure it out. Can't figure it out. So on a Wednesday of that week, I'm getting in my car after school, and this is another moment of clarity. And this little voice said to me, if what you're doing isn't working, try something different. And I thought, I have been trying to love Laura well, and it's just not working. I cannot do it. Well, Friday of that week, the phone rings, and it's Laura. Hey, Mom, how are you doing? Listen, I'm going to be home in a little bit, but I'm going to miss this show that I want to see, so if you would tape it for me, I would really appreciate it. As if nothing had happened. I said to her, Laura, I love you, and you can't come home. She said, what? And I said, I love you, and you can't come home. Well, her anger just exploded. I am chewed up, spit out, ugly. And I listened for a little bit, and then I said, I love you. And I hung up the phone. I'm standing in the kitchen, and I'm just so peaceful. And Bill walks in about that time, and he said, how's everything going? And I said, I just had a call from Laura. How is she? Well, I think she's okay, but Bill, I just told her she couldn't come home. And he said, Stephanie, do you think that was a good idea? He's never been to any Al-Anon meetings. I said, I don't know, but that's what I did. Well, you know what? The next morning, about 5 o'clock in the morning, I'm on my knees in my den going, what have I done? Oh, my God. That moment of clarity and that graced moment where everything is God is doing for you what you cannot do for yourself lasted one graced moment. You know, and I am back at my Al-Anon meeting that Saturday morning just crying my eyes out. And y'all are just great. You're just tapping my hand saying, did you know you could have a good day anyway? And I said, I can't. I don't know where my daughter is, and I don't know what I'm going to do. You know what, Stephanie? You can have a good day anyway. And you know what? I really did have a good day. So Laura's out of the house. We don't know where she is. She's not going to graduate, obviously. And I'm just, you know, I'm trying to get to a place of acceptance. Bill decides that she has a behavior management problem, and so he is looking for a treatment center for a teenager that has these problems, and he finds one in Denton, Texas. And so I called Blanche, and I said, Blanche, you know what? We just heard where Laura is, and I was wondering if I could call her and tell her, because we haven't heard from her. It's been a month. We didn't know where she was or what was happening. And so Blanche said, yes, but just be careful with what you say. So found out that Laura was over at Cherie's, so I called her, and I said, Laura, I needed to tell you that if you want help, your daddy has found a place that you can go. And you know, Laura, what do I have to do? And I said, well, we'll come pick you up in the morning and we'll take you to Denton, Texas. Fine. So we picked her up that Monday morning and we drove her to Denton, Texas. And I cried. You would not have believed my daughter. She had been living on the streets. She was sleeping under park benches. She was playing pool in pool halls and getting beat up. She looked horrible. Broke my heart. And all we could do is drop her off. The good news for me that day was that at least I knew where she was going to be for a while. At least I knew she was going to be safe. Well, she's there for a couple of days, and she calls, and she says, Mom, I've got something to ask you. And I said, what? And she said, I need to know how you would feel about me being an alcoholic. And I said, Laura, any 12-step program you want to latch on to is just fine with me. She said, we've been inventorying my drinking, Mama, and I've got a drinking problem. So April the 6th of 1987, Laura began her spiritual journey. This past April, Laura celebrated 22 years of sobriety. Ooh, I get God bumps just thinking about it. But you know what? We had to go to family week. And so in family week, we're talking a little bit and everything. And, you know, Laura got angry. And she threw a chair against the wall. And her counselor said, I don't think she's ready to come home yet. No kidding. You think? So they suggested that Laura go to a halfway house in Minneapolis, Minnesota. So that's what she did. We flew Laura up to Minneapolis, Minnesota, and she was in a halfway house for 4.5 months. Now I want to tell you about this awesome God that Blanche had been talking to me about. I wanted Laura to graduate from high school. God said, let's let her graduate by correspondence, and then let's give her a 12-step program to live the rest of her life by. I would have missed it. I just wanted that one little piece of the puzzle that was going to look good. And God said, yes, and here's more. So now Laura's sober, she's home, she's got a job, and we're going to open AA meetings together, and I just can't believe I've got this beautiful child that's sober, and her anger's getting better. She's working on that. And so now Wes is a senior in high school. Okay, great, let's go do Wes, you know. And he's a lot like his mom. He's been playing sports all of his life, trying to get his inside filled out up by the outside, just like I did. But right before his senior year, he gets very, very ill, and Wes ends up in the hospital with viral meningitis. He is in the hospital for 7 days with 104 temperature. I couldn't believe it. I cried. The difference for us this time was that Bill was with me, and we prayed together. And the Al-Anons and the AAs came and supported us. And we went to Dr. Ream Wednesday of that week, and we said, Dr. Ream, our boy's going to be okay, isn't he? And he said, I cannot promise you that. And Bill and I cried together and prayed together, and I called Blanche. And I said, Blanche, this boy has never hurt anybody, never done anything wrong. Why on earth would God give him this horrible, horrible disease? He might not make it. And Blanche said, Stephanie, God did not do this. Your boy is a human being and he got a virus. God will sustain you no matter what happens. And Wes came out of that illness. He had lost all of his body fat. He wanted to play football more than anything in the world, and he got to run for maybe one play. And then they had to pack his body in ice. But he did survive. And in May of that year, he graduated with his class on time. Walked across the stage. Kodak moment. I mean, you know, so I'm so happy. So Wes is going to the University of Texas, and Laura's got a job, and we're going to meetings, and everything's going really well. And Bill comes home one day and says, Stephanie, how would you like to move to Virginia? And I said, well, Bill, why would we do that? And he said, well, I've been traveling all of my adult life, and I'm tired of getting on airplanes. The kids are okay now. They're grown. Let's go. And I said, sure, let's go to Virginia. I said that because in 1990, houses in Austin, Texas were not selling. We were not going to sell our house. We were not going to Virginia. 2 weeks. Our house sold in 2 weeks. I cried, of course. You know, it's what I do. I cried because I wanted to be with Bill. I love Bill. But, you know, I didn't think I could do it. And so the AAs come and they're helping us paint and clean and do all this stuff. And I'm sitting in the middle of the floor just crying. And Tom, one of our dear friends, came up and he put his arms around me. And he said, "Stephanie, what is your problem?" I said, "Tom, I love Bill and I want to go, but I can't leave Austin." I said, "I cannot leave my children or my sponsor or my Al-Anon group or my gynecologist or my grocery store or the girl that cuts my hair. I can't go. I don't do change. I know I've been in the same town for 25 years and we've only lived in two different houses. I cannot go." And he said, "Stephanie, you know what you have in Austin, Texas. Why don't you go see what's in Reston, Virginia?" And you know what? They have Al-Anon in Reston, Virginia. They don't do it right, but they have Al-Anon in Reston, Virginia. I called Blanche. I said, "Blanche, you would not believe what happened in this meeting." She said, "What?" I said, "I don't think they mentioned a higher power one time. And I know they didn't talk about steps." And she said, "Well, what did you do, Stephanie?" And I told them how we do it in Texas. She said, "You might want to stop doing that." She was right, because when I stopped, the meetings got really good. So now Bill and I are in Virginia. I get to teach in this little school. He's got a job he loves. It's like we're on a second honeymoon. We are having the best time. We're going to AA and Al-Anon meetings. In fact, we're having a big book study in our home on Wednesday nights. This is so great. And the kids call Mom and we go, "Oh, love you, bye." It is the greatest. You know, it was so good. It was wonderful. It was just wonderful. Except we did get a phone call from Laura that we took. I wish we had changed our number, but we took this phone call and she said, "Mom, I need to tell you something." And I said, "What?" And she said, "I found Wes passed out last night." And I said, "What?" And she said, "Mom, Wes is drunk." And I said, "No." I said, "Because see, he saw his daddy nearly die of alcoholism. He saw you lose your home. Wes isn't going to take a drink." She said, "Mom, I took Wes to his first AA meeting today." So January the 10th of 1991, Wesley began his spiritual journey. I called Blanche and said, "How many miracles is one family allowed? I think we've used all of ours up." And she said, "Stephanie, you are limiting God one more time. There's no limit to the miracles." So now when we go back to Austin and we are in the open AA meetings and I'm holding hands with Bill and Laura and Wes and I cry through the whole thing, "Our Father." You know, I can't believe that we're all on a spiritual journey. What a blessing. What a blessing. So then I get a phone call from Laura about a year later and she says, "Mom, I need to tell you something." And I said, "What?" And she said, "I'm pregnant." I said, "No, honey, you're not." She said, "Mom, I'm going to have a baby." And I said, "No, you're not." She said, "Mother, do you want me to have an abortion?" I said, "No." And she said, "Do you want me to give the baby up for adoption?" And I said, "No." And she said, "What do you want?" And I said, "I do not want you to be pregnant." Blanche said I was opting for one of my unavailable choices. I did that a lot, probably still do today. Oh, my gosh. Laura had been sober 5 years. She and Charlie had been dating each other, but they weren't going to get married. They had just broken up. She's not going to have a baby. She can't have a baby because I told her on the phone, "You see, Laura, first you have the wedding, and then you have the baby. We didn't have a wedding. You will not have a baby." She says, "Mama, I'm pregnant." It was such a reflection on me as a mom. And it was such a reflection on you. She had been with you for 5 years. I was embarrassed. And I didn't tell anybody. I kept it a secret. And then after one of our big book study meetings one night, Rita and George were getting ready to leave. And I said, "Rita, you need to come here. I got to tell you something really bad." She said, "What?" And I said, "It's really bad." She said, "What?" And I said, "Laura's going to have a baby." She said, "Oh." She said, "And why is that bad?" And I said, "Because she's not married." I said, "She's not supposed to have a baby until she gets married." And Rita said, Stephanie, isn't it a shame that you have to label everything? Can it just be what is? It's just what is. The most beautiful baby you have ever seen in your life was born on June the 6th. Her name is Stephanie Grace. I have to tell you that it was the happiest day of my life. And I would have missed it because it didn't look right. Bill was there sober. Wes was there sober. I was there crying. Still am. Oh, my gosh. You couldn't wipe the smile off my face. Oh, I was so happy to be a grandma. And she was beautiful. And I need to tell you a couple little stories about Grace. She was in second grade, and the teacher asked the kids to stand up and introduce themselves. Grace stands up, and she says, Hi, my name is Grace. I'm an alcoholic, and I've got... My name is Grace. I'm an alcoholic, and I've got 7 years of sobriety. She had been going to meetings since before she was born. When you introduce yourself, that's what you say. I'm an alcoholic. Well, the teacher, was just, you're what? And Grace is her mother's daughter, so she put her hands on her hips and she said, Didn't you hear what I said? I'm an alcoholic. So the teacher called Laura, and Laura explained, and, Then one day she was at the AA club in Austin, and she went in, and she said, Gerald, I need to buy a big book. And he said, okay. And she said, how much do they cost? And he said, well, Grace, how much do you have? And she said, I've got this much. He says, that's just about how much they cost. And Gerald sold Grace a big book. And then that little girl turned around, and she said, now I need to find me a sponsor. All the girls that knew Laura were ducking. Well, Grace is 17 years old. She just turned 17 this past June, and she is beautiful. She's got some problems, but I just tell you, I adore that child. I adore her, and I would have missed it. And about a year later, I got a call and from San Antonio, and they told me that my daddy had had an abdominal aneurysm. It had ruptured, and he had died instantly. And I was devastated. I love my daddy. And as sad as I was to hear the news, that's how grateful I was that I was in a 12-step program. I had done a 9-step with my dad. He knew I loved him, and I knew he loved me the best he could. And it was peaceful for me. Extremely sad, but it was peaceful. Now I have to tell you the part of my story that I wish I didn't have to share. I think one of my biggest character defects is wishing that the past were different. And it's the one thing you can't change. It's the one thing you cannot change. In February of 1994, with 8.5 years of sobriety, Bill Butler could not live with his humanness, and he committed suicide. He had suffered from depression most of his adult life, and he had taken himself off of his antidepressants. I need for you to hear two things. One of them is AA works. Bill cherished his sobriety. And depression is an illness, and if it goes untreated, it will kill you. The things were going really good for him, and he thought he was feeling so good. The night before he died, we were out to dinner and we went to the grocery store. I had no idea. The psychiatrist I visited with later, I said, "Oh my God, how could this happen? Why would it happen? Why didn't he call me? We had been together 33 years. Why wouldn't he call?" And the psychiatrist said it was a moment of insanity. For him, that moment, life was horrible and was never going to get any better, and there was no way out. He didn't think about me. He was so self-absorbed. I think if he did think about me and the kids, he probably thought that we'd be better off. I don't understand that. We were doing good, I thought, you know. Bill apparently had a black hole inside of him that could not get filled. He needed help. The hardest thing I've ever had to do in my life was to call my children. And Laura said, "Mama, that cannot be true. Daddy loved you too much." And Wes said, "Mama, Daddy would never go off and leave you. He loved you too much." It's not about love. It's about an illness, a deadly illness. Y'all told me when I came into these meetings that I would never have to do anything alone again. And you were true to your word. It took every hug I have ever received, every piece of literature I've ever read, every phone call I've ever gotten for me to put one foot in front of another. I thought my life was over. But you supported me. You loved me. You said things to me like, "Breathe." I couldn't even breathe. The people in Virginia wanted to have a memorial for him. So the teachers from my school and the people from his work came to a memorial. And of course, so did the AA and Al-Anon community. One of my teachers came up to me and she said, "Who are all these people?" She said, "You've lived here 4 years. We've lived here 20. We don't know half this many." And I could say, "You're my family. They're my family." When I left Texas, Blanche and I stayed together always, phone calls constantly. But she insisted that I get a sponsor, like Ray was talking today, with that I could see eye to eye. And I had a sponsor for the 4 years I was up there. And she did not know what to do with me when Bill committed suicide. She didn't come to my house. She didn't call. She didn't do anything. She brought bagels one night and did not even want to come in and see me. Now, you know what? That's not her fault. I mean, really, you don't know what to say. You don't know what to do. But there was a lady there that knew what to do. Her name is Dawn. And Dawn called and said, "You know, if you ever need anybody to talk to, I'll be happy to talk with you," because Dawn knew pain. And I went and sat on Dawn's couch for hours on end and cried, and she held me. And Dawn became my Virginia sponsor. We brought Bill back to Texas and we buried him in Texas. Had a beautiful graveside service for him. The kids wanted me to come home right then, and I said, "No, I can't." I said, "I've got a job to do up here. I've got to do this job." The next year, you know, and I have to tell you something. I was going to meetings and I did have a sponsor and I was working the steps, but when this happens to you, so I needed some outside help. Thank God there was a woman named Nancy. And she explained to me that I had been traumatized. She said there is a difference between grief and trauma. There, you are in grief when something happens, you lose something. You are in trauma when something happens in your life and it will never be the same again. In one instant, your life changes and will never be the same again. That's called trauma. And she said, Stephanie, you've been traumatized and we need to work with you. And I went to see Nancy 2 and 3 times a week for 2 years just to try to get peaceful with a situation that has no answers for all those questions. So in 1995, the next year, both of my children got married. And I'm talking to Nancy, and I said, Nancy, you know, this feels like another loss to me. And she said, Stephanie, when children, your children ages, lose their family unit, and it's been kind of dissolved with the death, they will find it necessary to recreate that unit. And this might be practice marriages for your children. They were. But in 1995, in April, Laura got married, and in August, Wes got married. And then, the next February, almost 2 years from the day that Bill died, I walked into our house, and I went, he's not coming home. It took 2 years for the information to get from my head to my heart. I guess I just thought he was gone for a little while. And I walked in and it hit me, he's not ever coming home. And that night I called Laura and I called Wes and said, I think I'm coming back to Texas. And they said, that's great. See, one thing that I didn't know, well, Bill was an extremely dependable and effective employee, and he had been investing money in his company, you know, where you put in a dollar and they match it and all that kind of stuff. So when he died, there was this large sum of money. We've never had money. I didn't even know what to do with it. So when I decided to go home, I opened the doors of my house and said, y'all come get and take what you want, and that couch is 25 and that chair is 5, and just take it because I'm going home. So one of my teachers said, where are you going? Are you going back to Austin? And I said, oh, no, it's gotten too big. And I said, what I want to do is live near the water. I did not know that I love water. And you know what? I have never lived in a new house. I think it'd be kind of fun to live in a brand new house. And since I've been in Virginia, I've missed some sunsets. The trees are so tall in Virginia, you never get to see sunsets. And I have missed sunsets. Well, God said, okay. And so I bought a new house on Lake LBJ, and the sun sets over Pack Saddle Mountain right out my back door. And that's where I live today. It is beautiful. It is beautiful. It's a healing home. It was just so wonderful. So I got back there. I'm buying this house, and I had invested my money with this man, and I'd asked him when I moved back to Texas to please send the money down to Marble Falls so that I could have an eye-to-eye contact with this person that I was going to be meeting with, and he said, sure enough, and he tried to send the money, except that he couldn't because he had stolen the money. And so Bruce stole $300,000. It felt like another death in the family. I thought I was going to have this beautiful home. I thought I was going to be able to just travel with grace. I thought it was just going to be a fantastic, you know. And now I am scared to death. If you ask me how I feel, I just start crying. Because it's horrible. I mean, how could anybody do that? Well, I had invested my money with somebody, and I hadn't asked questions because he had been recommended to me. And I did press charges, and he did go to prison for 2 years. That was the maximum that they could give him. And they ordered him to make restitution, and so I got $25 every 3 or 4 months for a while. Last month, I got $126. I called Laura, and I said, Laura, guess what? She says, Mama, you're going to be so dead by the time this man finishes paying. Yeah, but you know what? I went to enough AA meetings, and y'all said to me, you better pray for Bruce. You better pray for Bruce. So there for a while I was going, God bless that. And today I say, God bless Bruce and his family. And that knot in my tummy has gone away. You know, it's just what is. Tragic, yes, because I have no job and very little money, and I don't know what to do. So I call Laura, and she says, Mama, pray for clear and concise direction. I said, okay, Laura. So I'm on my knees. God, clear and concise direction. That's what I need. We were sitting in a meeting today, and one of the gals, I think her Heidi, she said she needs a billboard. She doesn't need a little text message. I needed something. I don't care what. I was praying, God, tell me what you want me to do. I have this new home that is not paid for because Bruce said, no, 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 you're going to need a tax write-off. So I have an enormous house payment, and I have no means to support myself. Except that God said, guess what I'm going to do? I'm building an elementary school 7 minutes from your house. And guess what? They need a first grade teacher. And you know what? I'm teaching first grade in a school 7 minutes from my house. And guess what? I'm fine. Well, you know, I am a... Not quite fine. I am self-supporting through my own contributions. That's what I am. I am in this house, and I am teaching first grade, and I love it. And Dawn and I are still taught. Now, Dawn and I are doing long distance, and Blanche and I are seeing each other all the time. And I have this little red car, and it's got over 100,000 miles on it. But when you don't have any money, it's kind of hard to buy a car. And so Blanche was entering sweepstakes for me. And she would call and say, can you drive a Jeep? I said, yeah, Blanche, I can drive a Jeep. And then she'd call and say, do you like, you know, green? I said, Blanche is fine. Well, in the year 2000, Blanche was in an accident. And she was in the hospital. And in a little town called Temple, Texas. And it's about an hour and a half from where I live. So every Saturday I'd jump in that little red car and I would drive to Temple, Texas to try to see how Blanche was doing. And when I'd walk into her hospital room, she'd say, how's your car? I'd say, Blanche, it got me here. Don't worry about it. Let's get you well and get you out of here. Well, Blanche did not survive her injuries. And 7 weeks later, she died. And her daughter called me and she said, Stephanie, if you want to say goodbye to Blanche, you better come in a hurry. And I got in that little red car and I said, you know what, God, I did not get to say goodbye to my daddy. And I didn't get to say goodbye to Bill. Please let me say goodbye to Blanche. And I was holding her hand when she took her last breath. And I could tell her, oh my God, if it hadn't been for you and your willingness to share, you know, I am who I am today because you had a willingness. Well, they had a memorial service for Blanche shortly thereafter, and they asked me if I would speak. And I said yes, and that morning of the service, Laura calls me, and she says, Mama, you are going to tell them how important Blanche was to our family, aren't you? And I said, Laura, you hated Blanche. She said, Mama, she wanted you to teach me that there were consequences for my choices. She wanted you to hold me accountable, and she didn't want you to accept unacceptable behavior. And if it hadn't been for Blanche, she said, I think I would be dead today. And I got to share that. A few months later, the phone rings, and it's Blanche's daughter. And she said, I don't know if you're going to understand this or not, but I had a visit from my mother last night. Okay. She said, she's worried about your transportation. Thirty-some-odd years in Al-Anon, and she's worried about my transportation. I said, Ellen, I'm all right. I said, I'm going to make it okay. I said, you know, I get a check from that school. And I'd open that check, and guess what? It's not enough to make a house payment. But I told God right then, you know, God, I guess you want me teaching school because I've done the footwork. And God said, you betcha, I want you teaching school. And I said, Ellen, I'm going to be all right. And she said, no. She said, my mother wants you to have her car. And I said, oh, I could never drive Blanche's car. And she said, well, you'll have to argue with my mother and God. Blanche was driving a 99 Cadillac. All paid for, with 23,000 miles on it. I'm driving that Cadillac today. It now has 142,000 miles. We need to start entering sweepstakes. Except Don told me I could not say that from the podium ever again. You know what? I'm okay. You know, if you turn around and look at my life backwards, you would go, what an awesome God. What an awesome God. That he first decided that at some point there is a way to recover from this horrible disease of alcoholism. There is a way for the family to get well. And we were graced and blessed with this opportunity. And then every step of the way, this is what we're supposed to do. Dawn and I talk all the time, bless her heart. She always says to me, Stephanie, are you in present time? No. I'm worried about what I said yesterday or what's going to happen tomorrow. And she said, you know what, if you look at you today, you are in present time. I always look at the piece of the puzzle. I never look at the whole picture, can't see it. My deal today is to try to have the faith and the trust that I'm going to be okay no matter what, because it has got to be true. Laura is married today to a fine fella, sober in AA. They're raising Grace. Wesley got married. That one didn't work. He got married again. That one's not didn't work. But I've got a 3-year-old granddaughter. And so I have a 17-year-old granddaughter and a 3-year-old granddaughter. So I am so blessed. And I am in Taos, New Mexico. And I have made new friends today. I need to tell you that my home group is the One Day at a Time Al-Anon Family Group. We meet Monday nights at 7:30 in Marble Falls. If you want a good meeting, I hope you will come. I cannot tell you how much it means. You could be outside in this beautiful community, and you have been willing to listen to me this afternoon. I am humbled and touched, and I thank you.